Yeah, the layers and layers piled up on you. How can I get to you? I'm digging out, praying out, singing out, when will I find you? And of course, we all have a notion of what that you is that we're singing to, looking for, digging towards, singing towards, trying to find. And yet it really ties into the topic of reconciliation. Actually, it is reconciliation, because it's, Dr. Megan McElloran, I'm not sure how to say her name, talks about trauma, and when somebody has experienced a trauma, it's a loss of control, it's a severe disconnect, and so there's a need to, and a challenge of how to reconstruct a world that previously you could take for granted. And now, you know, the bottom has fallen out. Now it's come apart. And so who is the you? It's almost like you're looking for your own you in this path of looking for the greater you that I'm assuming this song is ultimately singing about. Yeah, layers and layers piled on. And a trauma that would, you know, approach the topic of resilience. There can be layers and layers as the severe disconnect, profound disconnect, and withdrawal can happen. And so, resilience. I told Connie a little while ago that, you know, I'm a process person, so we got to deal with some context here. We are talking about human beings, specifically. And we have got 100,000 years or more of breeding and seeing, and then whoever survives gets to breed again, and all this amazing path of who lives and who didn't, and, you know, and constant, you know, generations and generations and millions of generations, and down to where we are now, that we are like the very tip, the front little nanosecond tip of 100,000 years and more of shaping and evolution and survival that we got here. And so we are massively hardwired for survival. We all hear about flight or fight. Fight or flight. And that's gotten us to here, and it's been working pretty good, because here we are. And in a large way, it has served us well. And now it's very interesting, because evolution continues, and our greater understandings continue, our learnings continue. And society and our basic needs continue and change. And so for so long, all it was survive. You know, you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and the very bottom level is survive. And next comes food, along with survive. Just survive. Protect your young. Get at least one or two of them to survive and continue on. And so safety, survival, safety. And gradually, things kind of settled down, and we got into more stable communities and ways of living and agriculture and things like that. And so, you know, then you know, societal, social needs, you know, need for each other and belonging and things of that nature start kicking in. And then eventually we get to the Industrial Revolution. And so, you know, we're into efficiency, efficient production, and people become cogs in a machine, essentially. And so if something gets out of order, you just fix it. You know, if you're sick or you're hurt or a trauma happens, just fix it, recover, and move on. And it's very efficient. And so fight or flight changes a little bit. Sometimes I think I wonder about people's behavior. I realized as I was talking to myself coming into this talk that I wonder if people's some of their aren't very natural behaviors that many people will practice things like these little white lies. People apparently tell white lies all the time. We don't tell the truth. You know, how does that look on me? Great. You know, there's a running joke about wives asking husbands questions like that, and you know, it's kind of a survival thing. Looks great. And I wonder if that's part of what's behind this prevalence of lying when people don't even need to lie. You could have told the truth. Why not? And so there's a loss of authenticity, or that we have not yet gained real authenticity. That there's just this survival stuff is wired in, so hardwired, that we'll lie, just because it's almost like a little flight without leaving. That I didn't really participate in whatever this is. I'm not really going to, allow any vulnerability of myself. I'm just going to whoosh, right over it. Maybe, I don't know. I never ran across the concept before, but it's interesting. And so we're in the Industrial Revolution, and people become cogs, and efficiency is really important. And so efficiency in a lot of environments, and getting along easily and comfortably, social needs, etc., and some progress and self-esteem and things like that that are kicking in, that Maslow had not written about, move along. And so commonality of culture and values support efficiency really well. So people surround themselves, they're probably around people who are more like themselves than not. And this is a value. And so if we have a work situation that's all a bunch of how it used to be in government and a lot of businesses, it's all white males, they hire more white males because that's who they're comfortable with. It's the culture, it's the value system. This is comfortable and it's very efficient because we all understand each other, we know how we think, we have similar values, and this is very efficient. And it goes along like that, and then Abraham Maslow did his hierarchy of needs and spelled it out. We thought, that's interesting. And it was his study of normal personalities, normal people functioning. And he added on then, the thing that was showing up is that little self-actualization at the top. People were having experiences that were different from the norm, the everyday getting by, survival, being efficient. That they were having spiritual experiences, peak experiences. These experiences stood out. They were different. And when he was talking about it, he was talking about it in terms of that not terribly many people have these. This is something that's emerging. And that is enough to be noticed. But it's not necessarily commonplace or in the mainstream. But it happens, and it's interesting. This is in the 40s, 50s. Then in the 1960s, things change. We have revolution in society, where suddenly people are saying, this is not working out. It's not fair. There are whole groups of people being excluded from the mainstream of life. The good life, especially in this country and some other, developing countries. And so you end up with the civil rights movement, you get the women's movement, you get gay liberation, you get all these groups, stepping forward saying, hey, we want to play too. We don't like this business of that we're not at the table. And so everybody is now at the table, everybody's voice is heard, there's equality, a push for this, an inclusion, and we move forward. There's all this consciousness raising, and it starts to be a focus on self-improvement. And society starts to shift. And eventually there's a shift even in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and people are adding on a whole other transcendent levels above that, saying, well, now we have a focus on what's the common good, and what are the spiritual needs? Not just of individuals, but society. What's the common good? So there are additional levels, a transcendent consideration of needs. What's good for individuals, and what's good for society? What's good for all of us? And at that point, research starts showing up talking about resilience. So it's not just about something's broken, traumatized, disaster, so we just recover and fix it and move on, suck it up. Now you start seeing people talking about resilience. Not just recovering, but actually taking some traumatic situation or some situation that's painful or difficult and horrible maybe, trauma, and finding a way to turn it into something that actually makes one better. So resilience is not just about recovery. It's about recover and thrive. We've all heard stories of people who had cancer, got through cancer or got through some horrible disease or got through some long drawn out, terrible situation or struggle, and they come out the other end saying things like, I would never ever wish that on my worst enemy, and I certainly wouldn't want to repeat it, but I wouldn't trade it in for anything. It's changed who they are. They are now a better person for it, for having had that experience. And so there is resilience. A natural reaction to a traumatic event or protracted, intense struggle, people raising severely challenging, multiply disabled children or emotionally disturbed people or dealing with long-term, just intense bad situations or torture situations for years, or a situation like in Haiti or in Japan where the whole society crumbles because of a tsunami or an earthquake and people are just living in a terrible situation for years. And how do you come out the other end of it? The natural reaction is to pull away. Human beings, and there's your fight or flight again, if you're going to get hurt, and this hurts really bad, this is awful, this is agonizing, your natural reaction is to pull away, is to withdraw. And so people will naturally withdraw. They stay home, they stay indoors, they don't come out. Whereas initially okay, but you can't stay there because then your loss of control turns into, it becomes a fear of getting back into the game. And so that will just support your ongoing cycle of discomfort and pain and fear and loss of control. You never can get it back. You don't ever find you again. You just lost you and you can't find you as long as you stay inside your own home with the doors closed and the lights off. And so you have to find a way to reconstruct this world that you used to take for granted. And so that instinctual urge to pull away has to be countered, and an antidote for it is re-engagement. And something else that this Dr. McElroy says that something that's really tough in this society that's been growing over the last few decades is the myth of happiness, that everybody should be happy. And if you're not happy, something's wrong with you. And so we've got to shift that value in society, that all of human experiences are valued, so that whatever is going on with anyone, they're not going to be judged because they're miserable or they're not happy. And so what is resilience? We all have a notion, like you were saying earlier, it's bouncing back. Mine's not a super ball. It does not bounce higher than it started. Mine bounces lower than it started. But, yeah, I like the super ball even better, where you bounce it and it goes way. It gets energy out of the collision so that it actually goes higher than it started. That's resilience, yes. This is just kind of a low form of recovery. But if it goes even higher than where it started because it got energy out of the experience, it got better than it started. It's thriving. That's real resilience. Where you're coming back, you're bouncing back from a disruption to normal functioning to back into functioning, and you're doing it with skill and flexibility, and you're expanding from it. And this a little bit touches back on the old Puritan notions of that, struggle and fighting and sucking it up builds character. Yeah, it does, actually. It turns out that's one of the things that supports getting back, coming back with even more strength. That resilience implies that there is a positive to this recovery, to this bouncing back, and that you are thriving. And it depends in part how well people come back. Depends in part on what they came in with. If you're coming in fairly strong, you've got positive capacities, you've got an ability to be adaptable, you're flexible, you've got coping strategies, you've got some education, because people with education have more choices and are aware of their choices. If you grew up in a situation that was supportive and loving, if you grew up in situations where you're stable and you're safe and you've got you're optimistic in general. You have more chance of and more opportunity for resilience because you've got more resources. You've got more controls that you can bring to whatever is happening. So you can see where if somebody has got a really tough childhood where they grew up in an abusive situation or dangerous situation, someplace where they are not supported, they're not developing their capacities, they're just always getting pounded on emotionally or physically, they don't even know what normal is. Now, what kind of worldview are they trying to recreate? And so those folks are coming in at a disadvantage and are going to need a different kind of support if something traumatizing lands on them. We've got researchers demonstrating all kinds of things that are really supportive of resilience. Big ones that come up over and over again are social support, optimism, adaptability, and that you've had some experience with challenges and difficulties previously. Not crushing, damaging experiences, trauma that will just tear you apart, not that, but little challenges along the way where you didn't just always live the perfect good life, this whole perfect and complete as it is all the time in a safe, protected environment. That, yeah, you had to deal with things along the way. And if you got some practice, you're probably better off. Now we get into the really fun stuff. And like I said before, people have been working with Maslow's hierarchy of needs and adding multiple levels on top of it that stretch into that there's space for spirituality. Not just a single person, but in the collective. In the collective, there are shifts going on. It expands opportunity for everyone. It expands stability and positiveness for everyone, just because it's in the mind. And there is a focus on the common good. Now, some of what's happening here is the neuroscience is getting into these areas and feeding our understanding of what's going on with brain function. All this stuff coming out about brain function is just stunning. And things I'm talking about here are coming from an interview with Dr. Elisha Goldstein. And we've heard before that we've got this old reptilian brain that's back here that's really just all about survival and breathing and processing. Much of what goes on with keeping us going is functioning at a subconscious, unconscious level, that we're just not part of it. We are not running our breathing. We're not controlling our heart rate. We're not doing those things. They're just all running on a sub-program. Is it Thomas Eagleton talking about that? I can't remember the name of his book. But talking about that we've got all these millennia of years bringing us to here, and most of what is running us, we don't even participate in on a conscious level. It just is functioning. And we have reactions that we didn't even know we had. Somebody says, why'd you do that? Well, and I don't know. Well, and we truly don't. Our cognitive mind doesn't know why we did that. Why'd you react like that? Well, I don't really know. What are you thinking? I don't really know. And it's, you know, it's a reaction. It's way deep, and it just happens. And so we're wired that way. And this executive function that's going on in the prefrontal cortex is all about sense making and thinking deciding a response, choosing goals, making decisions about motivation, finding motivation. So we got this reptilian limbic brain going on, and also the one they talk about with the amygdala, where that fight or flight kicks in, where something happens and we get this hit emotionally, and we are all about survival. But we find that if we reflect, if we get involved with reflection and just hold on a second before we react to something, then it slows all those old deep processes down. And you're giving your fine mind, the prefrontal cortex, where all the sense-making and the thinking and decision-making going on, a chance to get into whatever's going on. And so reflection and changing the perspectives looking at things a different way, thinking about them, mulling them over, slows everything down, and it actually maintains the plasticity of the brain. The brain can change. And if we do this long enough over years and years and we keep it going, we actually can change the physicalness of the brain and how it functions. And so we find that the brain is very resilient, and it becomes more resilient if we, and I'm quoting here, steadily cultivate positive, pro-social emotions like gratitude, kindness, compassion, serenity, awe, delight, and love. The brain actually becomes more expansive, has an optimistic perspective where we can again discern options and possibilities. And MRIs can demonstrate this physical shift of electrical activity when we shift to things like reflection, giving, slow down this reaction that just comes with the package. It's part of our operating system. It's the foundation of it. It keeps us here going, got us to here. But if we can slow it down now, because we're not the same people anymore, our minds and our thinking are not the same people that our bodies are still having as a foundational operating system. We're sort of outgrowing some of our reactions. The evolution, we're really not that far out of the trees. So we still have biological impulses and reactions that don't necessarily fit how we want to be. We still see it in behavioral kinds of things, which is drawn by biology. And we can pick them out. You can watch the behavior in bars on a Friday night. Look at that. things like that. But we are changing. We are shifting. And a lot of this shift, we now know, is in our own hands or our own minds. And so, yeah. How can I get to you? How can I get to you? Something bad happens. I can tell you that people can pick all the wrong ways to react. My family had a big trauma several decades ago, did not have a clue how to handle it, handled it totally wrong, and just pretty much was not good for the family. Truly changed how people turned out as human beings. And it was like somebody took a massive apple corer to my dad's heart and soul and just ripped it right out of him. And I did not realize how badly he was damaged until, as a much older adult, looking at him and thinking back, realizing that nobody had a clue, that he was just hollow from that point on. And then other stuff happened later that just exacerbated. He didn't deserve that. And that's one of the things we have to recognize, is that, yeah, life's not fair. And acceptance of that, acceptance of, yeah, here's what's going on right now, helps move forward. You don't have to live there. I've got a quote on a little board at home that says, you can't prevent the birds of sorrow or something like that from flying over your head, but you don't have to let it build nests in your hair. Yeah, really. So, reflection, allowing the mind to take a look at things from different perspectives, sounds a whole lot like mindfulness. And it turns out that two things that really, really slow down the mind and allows it to do this are mindfulness and compassion. Mindfulness being that we feel our way into the sense of what's going on. We feel our way into our experiences. It's a heartfulness about how it is now. Not dragging along emotional baggage. Not, the specificity about what's history. But how it is now. What's going on now? And what happens when we do this, when we focus on mindfulness and compassion, which is that expansion on Maslow's hierarchy, we're into what's the common good? What's good for other people? What is supportive and kind? This actually strengthens the functioning of the prefrontal cortex and its related structures. So the things that we've known were good for us now are showing up in the science saying, yep, sure enough, it is. We can change the physical part of the brain to do the things that we thought were all about spirituality. And somehow that just all makes sense to me. So if we practice mindfulness, it allows us, and if we have a mindful practice, or if we have a spiritual practice of mindfulness, basically what we're doing is applying this strengthening of our brain, of how we are, that not only are we changing our experience of life, but we're actually applying it to our life, and we're changing our brain. As we experience our life differently, we are actually, if we continue this on, we're actually changing our brain function. It changes our wiring. And when we change our wiring, we change how we are. It's an evolutionary process. We also know that you can pass the effects of massive stress and trauma onto children, you know, genetically. You look at some families that came out of terrible trauma like the Holocaust, where they got away, they survived, and they came here, and then they had children. And you can sometimes watch as things are passing down through how the children are responding things to events and to circumstance and experiences in their own lives. What do they have to draw from? And it turns out, as they're watching some of these longitudinal studies, that people are saying, yeah, some of this effect is being passed on genetically because the parents were physically changed by the experience, and they passed some of that, the genetics, on to their children. And so, for science of mind, and Abraham's law of attraction, this is very interesting because we are truly changing who we are and how our brains can function. We're sort of ratcheting up the capacities and the capabilities. And so meditation, yoga, mindfulness, all of these allow us to step back and to look at the bigger picture and look at how we are and to reflect and to figure out that not everything that we think is true and that we can have something to say about it. And so as we practice mindfulness and compassion, we are expanding our capacity for equanimity, for calm. You were talking about calm earlier and emphasizing calm. It turns out that calm is a major coping skill, and it's a kind of a key to a lot of the rest of this, because if you can calm your mind and get it just to settle for a minute, just for a little bit, then you can allow the rest of the mind to kick in and to think and to reflect and to realize what is really going on here, and accept and kick in some of these higher level processes. And so if we can expand our capacity for equanimity, we can stay calm and relaxed while at the same time being engaged and alert. So we, as Goldstein says, you can't avoid the disasters and things that go on in human condition. Things happen. Bad things happen to good people. Just is. Life is not fair, not just as it is. And you can't avoid these human experiences, but you can meet adverse events from a grounded and flexible resilience. We can bounce back, and we can even learn valuable lessons from our experiences. I've heard this thing that says, the harder I work, you know, that luck is really important to success, and that the harder I work, the luckier I get. With this, I realize it's kind of like the more I practice mindfulness and compassion, the more my default is positivity and optimism and being happy. And so, Abraham talks about 17 seconds. If you can just pause, give yourself, you know, calm down, breathe into your heart space. Just that touch triggers oxytocin, calms you down, allows you to settle a bit. And if you then spend some time putting your mind on where you want it to be, 17 seconds, and stay there, then some more thoughts attach on, and just stay there, stay calm, stay alert, stay engaged, and then some more can unfold. You're way ahead. First of all, you're calming immediately, and you're shaping how you respond, and you're practicing mindfulness and compassion for yourself, for others, creating, co-creating a more positive experience. You're learning. You're still maintaining a sense of some control, especially if you're doing this with other people, re-engagement with other people, talking to people, having that social support of family, friends, whomever, somebody. If you're experiencing a terrible trauma, something disastrous, just having one person who is there to be with you, and you know, not be judging, just to be with you and to listen and to go through this, walk through this together, listen to it, the more you are able to be resilient. And that's 17 seconds into 68 seconds into changing your brain over time. So, trauma is loss of control. Resilience is bringing all your resources, all your capabilities, your ability to pause, calm yourself, allow higher level thinking and functioning to kick in. Take advantage of the things that you know how to do, no matter what is going on, getting connected with this amazing creative force of all. Having something to say about what's going on with your mind and what are you thinking. Stick with it long enough so that it can gather some momentum. Change your brain function. You change who you are and you increase your capacity for resilience. And of course, then you bring that, if you are calm, if you can do that, you can do it for yourself, and you can do it for others. And then, humans continue to grow, and to evolve, and to turn into who it is perhaps we really, truly would like to be. One thing, what happens when you do all of that, here it is. You had a closing statement. This is Joan Borisenko. If you do all of these things, this all helps you to change the story you tell yourself when the difficult happens. If you think your difficulties are a challenge, you'll find that difficulties are a way to develop compassion. And your difficulties then become a way to change your brain and to change your life.
Thank you.
Yes.